5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the Board of Directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
In many ancient worldviews, blood is not merely a bodily component, but the seat of life itself. In the Bible, in Leviticus 17:11, it says that the life of the flesh is in the blood, and the dietary laws of Deuteronomy and Leviticus forbid the consumption of blood, precisely because it is understood as ingesting the soul force of a creature. Early commentary even links this prohibition to the corruption that preceded the flood in Genesis 6, where the hybrid beings who were born of divine human transgression consumed blood as a form of violation, not just sustenance. And then centuries later, in an entirely different cultural setting, the traditional vampire lore is born, and it would echo that very idea.
You have entered the 21st century dystopian portal. Welcome to confusion. Welcome to question. And welcome to clarity. The life is in the blood.
Vampires don't drink blood for nutrition. They drink it for vitality. They drink it for identity because it's a life force. In fact, the earliest written figures to drink blood for essence rather than for food appear in the Enochian accounts of the giants, making the conceptual overlap between ancient hybrid predators and later vampiric beings far less accidental than it might appear at first. The metaphysical logic is literally identical in both traditions, but the language drifts across time. These old Enochian texts go on to claim that when the giants perished in the flood, their bodies died, but their spirits didn't, and that these disembodied entities cursed to roam the earth until the final judgment were said to harm the living. They were said to tempt them. They were said to inhabit their bodies and cause disease. And what emerges in these passages is the earliest recognizable blueprint for the revenant, a sort of possessing demon, and the entire category of the undead but not dead. It's not hard to see that Balkan folklore mirrors this uncannily. The vampire is described as a restless dead, a spirit trapped in a body that refuses proper burial, an entity that lingers where it shouldn't. Both systems attempt to articulate essentially the same haunting intuition. There is a creature that should not exist, that refuses the boundary of death, and that preys upon the living as the consequence of its essentially unnatural state. And I think before we get too deep into this, because indeed, this is quite a bizarre episode, guys, and I have been hesitant to make one on vampires for a long time because of the absolutely crazy cult following that vampires and werewolves have independent of each other, and we'll get more to that later. But we need to consider a couple questions first. We need to ponder a couple things first. Christians like to say things like demons are the spirits of dead Nephilim and stuff like that. But how true, why do we think that exactly? Because if you ask the question, are all demons Nephilim? The answer is most definitely no. We have entities like Legion to kind of prove that. So is it just that all dead Nephilims are demons, or are they a different type of creature altogether? A different type of spiritual entity? Because I think humans get a little ahead of themselves when they think that they've got the whole spiritual world mapped and they've just identified what all of these spiritual things are, when literally they have no way of conceptualizing it because they can't really see it. And I know, as was portrayed in my last video, several people who watch this show or have watched this show think that they are God's very own little Geralt of Rivia, his little spiritual witch or warlock monster hunter, but that contradicts itself in of itself. And so I don't think we can really understand everything that goes on in the spiritual realm. And I think there should be a certain amount of open-mindedness when it comes to the very concept of demons. And, you know, according to my last episode, I don't think we should ponder these things too much, but I'm more pondering etymology and lineage at this point than I am the beings themselves.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Disease hit hard this year, huh?
Yeah. Mother Nature threw the kitchen sink at us. Tar spots, southern rust. We had everything.
I didn't know if my fungicide would hold, but Miravis Neo really came through. Even with that dry spell, our yield monitor did not disappoint.
Seriously?
Yep, and with results like this, I'm sticking with it.
No matter what next season brings, protect your ROI with Miravis Neo. Call your retailer to lock in your supply today. Always read and follow label instructions.
And I just think that it's essential when tackling these specific monsters that we're going to cover, specifically vampires, werewolves, incubus and succubus types, stuff like that, it's important to understand that these are probably actual demons and not necessarily just Nephilim. There might be more than just Nephilim on the planet because, for instance, we know there are multiple different types of angels. We know there are multiple different types of angelic entities. And so why would we not assume that there are also multiple different types of spiritual beings on the earth? You know, that not everything has to be a Nephilim. Some things are literally a different demonic, fallen, evil, spiritual entity than what we see in the Book of Enoch. So, the spiritual realm, in my opinion, is essentially as familiar to us as the distant reaches of the universe. We are spiritual beings ourselves. So unlike, let's just say, a chicken or a dog or a cow, we do know that a universe exists and that we are a mere member of it. Whereas the dog or the chicken or the cow, they do not know that there is a, you know, Milky Way up above us, a galaxy, a universe. They're just living in the moment on a sort of survival instinct basis. But since we are spiritual entities, we do know that there is a lot out there that we don't understand. And that's important to keep close to your heart and your mind when you're tackling these types of topics. The person who thinks that they know everything about the spiritual realm is possibly the most deceived person you'll ever come across. It's also my personal belief that we don't really have the capability to understand everything that's in the spiritual realm, because if we did, our brains would literally explode. And that's kind of outlined in the Bible as well. There's things we're just not supposed to know. And there were things that already we were not supposed to have known, but thanks to Adam and Eve eating of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, we now do know. But that does not mean that we know everything or even can know everything without our brains literally exploding in the flesh. We would not be able to handle it. So, the spirit realm is as unknowable as anything can be, save for a few hints, thanks to what we've seen here on Earth that have been written by other men. And of course, there are the people who believe that angels and demons and all of these entities come to them specifically because they're somehow special or something like that, and give them all of the knowledge of the universe. And so I think it's safe to say that the true number of different types of spiritual beings that are out there is unknowable to us. So as I go forth in this episode, you're going to find things that you disagree with. A lot of you probably disagree with what I said already, but when you look at the lore, when you follow the timeline of events, when you look at the legends and the myth and all of the stories and all of these different things, there are correlations that point to a few main culprits or types of culprits that are so similar that they do appear to be, in fact, the same entity. And philosophers and theologians and folklorists have long noted that giants and vampires, Nephilim and vampires, are united by a kind of deeper symbolic logic. Each is essentially a figure of excess. They possess excessive appetite, excessive strength, excessive lifespan, excessive desire. Augustine referred to the Nephilim as literally the swollen ones, not because of physical size alone, but because their very being was bloated with corrupted will. Early vampire accounts in Eastern Europe describe the undead in strikingly similar terms: engorged, drum-tight, tick-like entities that are filled beyond natural capacity. And as scholars like Barber and Dundas observe, this is also the case. Both traditions warn of these types of beings who take more than the world is structured to hold. In Slavic lore, vampires are said to possess bad blood, and not in the Taylor Swift type. Their blood is wrong. It is unsettled. Medieval scholars believe vampirism arose when a corpse retained blood that was infused with demonic presence. Blood in both systems emerges as a medium of identity. It's a spiritual carrier. Corrupted blood becomes the source of corrupted appetite. The fear underlying these traditions deepens when confronting the question of survival. And according to Enoch, the giants that died in the flood, they died, but their spirits remained. This would mean then that so too did those ancient predators in some way or another. Vulcan lore takes an eerily parallel stance because the dead return, they multiply. They target bloodlines, and they persist until they are deliberately and violently destroyed. Now, both the Nephilim and the vampire represent an old human terror that the past did not stay buried. The monstrous beings once existed, and that the world failed to eradicate them completely, therefore they still exist. Modern philosophers from Zizek to Agamben to Derrida, as well as anthropologists studying cannibalistic figures in history and mythology, have pointed out that both vampires and the descendants of these Nephilim symbolize something that's even more disturbing. Beings whose existence depends on draining the essence of others. And you can see how that doesn't just have to be blood. Their horror is not necessarily rooted in evil for its own sake. It's not rooted in the size of their fangs or the size of their body or their fingers or their appearance in any way whatsoever, really, but in the dependence that they have upon our life force. They require the life of others to maintain their own. They are essentially anti-human, not because they are necessarily cruel, but because their survival is incompatible with ours. They are parasites that are our size or bigger. And that's just so, so creepy. More than any superstition, that is what makes these ancient hybrids and undead predators feel like two reflections of the same nightmare, if you ask me. Just one born in a pre-flood world, while the other is said to be roaming through the folklore of the old world. Both kind of mimicking the same truth, that some hungers just shouldn't exist, and yet do. So as you might be able to see by now, vampires are much more simple than it might seem, and believing in them much easier than it may seem if you just give it a little bit of thought. I don't know how, for instance, someone might believe in something such as, let's just say, Bigfoot or Dogman or any other hidden monster of the forest, but leave out completely the concept of a vampire. I think like most people probably assume that because there are so many fanciful accounts of vampires, like Dracula and Nosferatu and Elizabeth Bathory, etc., 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 there is quite literally no shortage of fantasy tales with vampires at the proverbial helm of horror. And so because of that, we put them in the same category as any other bedtime story that you tell your kids. Therefore, they must not be real. But you've got these movies like Interview with a Vampire, 30 Days of Night, The Lost Boys, Salem's Lot, of course, Bram Stoker's Dracula, just to name a few. These things are thoroughly ingrained in our culture, and not just our culture, but pretty much every culture. So if something is thoroughly ingrained in every culture, the first thing that I always ask myself is, I wonder why. Because sure, there's tons of places that have local folklore. But when something becomes a global folklore, then it kind of, you have to start asking, actually, is this just history? Because the important thing to realize is that it was Dracula that essentially turned the vampire into this romanticized creature that it is today. And through that transformation, the fairy tale-esque masquerade turned a literal Nephilim demon horror creature that feasted on human flesh, a man-sized parasite, into this misunderstood, this hard to resist, but at the same time somehow creepy as hell, but in a weird kind of understandable cute way, and in some ways like a strange type of afflicted species to sympathize with. But that wasn't always what vampires were. They used to actually be literal horrors to people. Like, actually, like, just as scary as walking around in the woods and encountering a rabid wolf. Like, just, they were bad. In essence, though, that's the way propaganda works, right? If we don't want you to believe in something, or we want you to believe something is not as bad as it is, we give it sparkly skin and a cute smile and linguistics. So, it's a demon, humanized, given a form that we understand and feel as if we can save. It's it, what was feasting upon us, we have turned into our pet, a pet monster that simultaneously would keep us like a canary. So before vampires were turned into this beautiful porcelain British entity with a lovely little accent who can save us from ourselves, perfect enough for the silver screen and killable with silver bullets, a name for these things was the Vrykolakis. And this is where it gets really freaking interesting. Because not only does this explain some of the most important origin stories of this vampire creature, but it also goes into the werewolf, which people nowadays just call Dogman. Because why? Because werewolf just sounds too fantastic. It sounds too fantasy-esque. It's too Harry Potter. It's too Lord of the Rings. It's too, like, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't bite the same way as our new name for it, Dogman. And that is why you can kind of see how we transform things, we change things, we give them different names, we give them different characters, if you will, but they're the same actor.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose Masterforce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from Masterforce today. Check out all our Masterforce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
The Greeks long believed that certain lives cast a shadow, and some of those shadows went so deep that the soul would not be able to rest after death. A person who lived sacrilegiously, who died under excommunication, who was buried in unconsecrated ground, or who ate the flesh of a sheep that was wounded by a wolf, for instance, or worse, a werewolf, risked again coming to life as a Vrykolakis. And the Greek revenant, whose legend would later fuse into the broader vampire mythos. So, we have a little bit of an origin story here, huh? And isn't it weird how it involves the werewolf? In fact, some traditions claimed that a werewolf itself, once killed, could return as a particular powerful one of these Vrykolakis types. These vampire entities. So, what are we seeing here? We're seeing that the werewolf and the vampire come from the literal same entity. And they have some of the same traits as each other. They have these wolfish traits, the fanged jaws, the palm hair, the glowing eyes. And this belief became one of the earliest and the most explicit links between the Dogman, the werewolf, and the vampire. And even if you watch Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I just did last night for the first time, I was shocked to see that time when he's feasting on that chick who's always got her boobs out, he looked like a werewolf. Even though he was supposed to, I think, be a giant bat, he looked like a werewolf, and this is actually culturally and historically significant. The bodies of these Vrikulakas types were said to mimic the infamous vampires of Balkan folklore. So instead of decaying, they would swell up like a tick, grotesquely. They would become drum-like, these huge, tense with gas and blood beings, and their skin would be all disgusting but disturbingly lifelike. Some accounts even call them fresh and gorged with new blood, an image that would, of course, haunt the villagers, where people with red hair and gray eyes were once suspected of vampiric heritage. And you can link that back to through Nephilim bloodlines as well. These revenants, if you will, rarely just rose up for benign reasons. They quite literally stalked villages. They disturbed homes with a sort of poltergeist-like violence. And in darker tales, they even sparked epidemics, like COVID. One chilling detail still persists across rural Greece, and that is that the Vrikulakas would knock upon a door and whisper the name of the resident. And if no answer would come on the first call, then the creature would just kind of harmlessly pass by. But if somebody did reply, they were marked for death in that moment. They were destined to join the ranks of these restless dead types. And this is why, in certain villages, people still refuse to answer a first knock. Because myth and legend and lore, a lot of times, is rooted in actual history. So, like the Bulgarian vampire, the Vrikulakas was said to suffocate sleepers by sitting on their chests. And what does that sound like? Kind of like a succubus. We'll get more into that later. But unlike most vampires, Greek tradition describes them as cannibals, with a particular hunger for not necessarily the blood, but the human liver. And that is also freaking gross and disgusting. Now, the legends continue to warn that these types, the Vrikulakas, only grew stronger the longer that it was left undisturbed. Destroying its entire body was essential, and according to some traditions, only possible to do on a Saturday. That was the one day of the week when the creature would rest in its grave, which is another idea that is echoed in Bulgarian vampire lore. Are you starting to see where all of this is coming from? Destruction protocols were absolutely gruesome, as you can imagine, but standard. You know, you had the exorcism, the impalement, the beheading, the dismemberment, and of course, the most important part, the cremation of the thing. Only fire could really free both the creature and its victims from this ongoing curse that it had on it over the land, I guess. And even into the 20th century, belief in these things remained widespread in rural Greece. As a matter of fact, during the Great Famine of 1941 and 42, when roughly like 300,000 Greeks starved to death and graveyards were quite literally overflowing, families were forced to bury loved ones outside consecrated cemeteries. And this was a big problem because in the chaos, officials of the collaborationist Hellenic state dumped bodies into mass graves. And the fear that those buried in unconsecrated soil might return as Vrikulakas, as vampires, was pretty much, it was a big deal to the grieving families because they were like, if we do this, then they're going to come back and they're going to come back as demons and consume our livers. So a lot of families who were desperate to prevent their dead families from becoming revenants resorted to beheading their family members before burial. And that just shows how terrifying this reality really was to these people, and that it resurfaced as early as 1941. I mean, that's a pretty gruesome ritual, if you will, to bring back into basically the modern times, the near modern times. This fear stretches far deeper than even medieval lore. Ancient Greeks believed that the dead could reanimate into a liminal undead state, which is they were neither living nor gone. And burials of suspected revenants do appear as early as the Neolithic period. So that's like 4500 BC. So that's a little bit before Team Edward, right? We're talking people have been afraid of this stuff for a long time. In Cyprus, corpses were pinned into their graves with millstones over the head or chest. And similar burials appear all over the world, but especially at Argolid as well. In the necropolis of Camarina, one adult corpse had its head and feet trapped beneath heavy fragments to prevent it from rising up. Another grave near that area held a child that was weighed down by five large stones. This all seems like primitive ritual, but this outlines an actual real horror that people had at this time. And that horror had to come from somewhere. It's not like you just imagine that your five-year-old is going to rise out of the grave and feast upon your liver. In Attica, archaeologists found a lime kiln that was repurposed as a tomb for two dismembered individuals. A woman who was cut horizontally in half and placed prone, and the partial remains of an adult male leg. And their bodies were sealed beneath these massive heavy rocks, which was obviously a clear attempt to contain what the living feared they might become. And I'm sure you can connect the dots at this point. Under Ottoman rule, and then, of course, continuing into modern Greece, the methods grew even more explicit. A brutally Hannibalistic burial was found in which an adult's neck, pelvis, and feet were pinned like a butterfly with 20 centimeter nails. Like, that's... why would you do that to any normal person? Another grave held a man over 60 with three bent spikes among his bones. And there are alleged Vercolicus burial sites discovered all over the place, but there are some that include middle-aged men pinned through the neck, groin, and ankles using the same long nails that have been seen throughout the Balkans. As late as the mid-1800s, British Vice Consul Charles Thomas Newton reported that Greeks still designated special islands for burying suspected vampire types. This is something that wasn't really beautified, if you will, turned into some sort of fantasy love story until quite recently. It's kind of like one more way that they de-demonize the demons. And there's practices that are used to prevent revenants from rising, and they're quite varied and quite symbolic. Some corpses were interred upside down, others surrounded with like scythes or sickles to decapitate or distract intruding spirits. The ancient Greek custom of placing a coin in their mouths, which traditionally was interpreted as payment to cross the river Styx, that could have also originally served as a deterrent to malevolent forces that were seeking entry through the mouth of the dead. And the Greeks just have all sorts of stuff on this. And later in other folklore, sealing a corpse with a wax cross or placing like pottery inscribed with Jesus Christ type lingo upon the chest were just one more way that they believed they would prevent the undead from rising again. All across Europe, people are doing absolutely grotesque things to their dead loved ones, whether it's dismemberment or chopping their heads off or cutting their tendons at the knees or pinning them to the ground or crushing them with rocks, or they're scattering poppy seeds on them. And it's all rooted in this idea that they believe the revenant would be compelled to conquer these things before being able to come back to the land of the living. So like in the case of the poppy seeds, and this is, I can't remember what other legend it is, but maybe it's the Fae. I can't remember now. But the poppy seed idea is that they have to count all the poppy seeds, or they have to count the grains of sand or salt or whatever before they're able to enter the world again. It's this sort of a rhythmomania motif, I guess, and it appears all over the place in Chinese, Indian, and South American traditions. It's a very interesting motif, if you will. I have a feeling that vampire enthusiasts everywhere are going to hate me for pointing this out, but scholars like Alvaro Garcia Marin have argued that from a Western European viewpoint of the early 1700s, the prototypical vampire was actually Greek, not Slavic. So the Greek Vrakalakis appeared far earlier in Western theological treatises and travel literature than this beloved Slavic type.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.
Let's get to arguably the most bizarre part of this episode, which is the fact that vampires and werewolves are probably the same actual thing. And when you see a dog man, you might actually be seeing a vampire. And when you see a vampire, you might also be seeing something that could be a dog man or a werewolf. Because according to mythology and lore, if you go far enough back, they're actually the same thing. But for most modern enjoyers of this type of entity, this culture of monsters, vampires and werewolves do exist as two separate things. There's the suave, nocturnal blood drinker, right? And then the feral shapeshifter howling under the full moon or whatever. But if you walk backward through history, you will find that that boundary between them vanishes almost completely. The Greeks, the Balkans, the Slavics, all these traditions don't draw a line between the undead vampire predator and the wolfman. Instead, they describe something that's way stranger, a single ancient creature that's capable of shifting through forms depending on how it lived, how it died, and how it returned. So going back to the Vrakalakis, you see an entity that kind of occupies the center of this convergence. The Greeks believed that certain transgressions, such as living a sacrilegious life, dying in an excommunicated way, being buried outside of consecrated ground, or consuming the wrong kind of meat, that would cause a person to transform after death. Some traditions go even farther, that a werewolf upon death was said to rise as a powerful vampiric being. And it oftentimes still had wolf-like jaws. It had hairy palms and big hands and those eyes that we kind of associate with the lichen and all of that. But the belief is not just a footnote. It's one of the earliest and clearest indications that the werewolf of life and the vampire of death were seen as successive forms of the same monstrous condition. And there's other traits to the Vercolicus as well that give it that sort of wolf-bound characteristic. You have the predatory strength. It roams restlessly. It has a fixation on doorways and thresholds. The suffocating attack upon sleeping victims. These are behaviors shared with the Bulgarian vampire lore and with the European nightmare spirit known as the mare, a creature that is also strongly tied to werewolf traditions. And in Greek folklore, you also have many revenants that are less interested in drinking blood and more focused on cannibalism, particularly a hunger for human livers. So you see this line between human eater, wolfman, and corpse drinker essentially dissolve in a way. Slavic tradition tightens this knot even further because the Serbian word, and I'll probably pronounce some of these words wrong, guys, I apologize, but Vukodlak, which has been used for centuries, and it means wolf-haired one, as well as vampire. And that's just one single term standing in for two entire different categories of modern monsters in the Western world. And the villagers didn't really distinguish the supernatural wolfman from the undead corpse back then. They recognized a single predator whose violence might express itself differently depending on whether it still walked on living legs or reanimated ones. It's only later, much later, that literature and eventually cinema separated these identities into these neatly labeled different creatures. And then you have like the movies like Underworld and stuff like that, where all of a sudden now they're even warring with each other. You got the lycans versus the vampires and all that kind of stuff. But if you go basically back to just past the 1700s, you're going to see that they're actually the same exact creature in these cultures that quote unquote invented or first encountered these things. So I'm not really sure how you explain that, and I know that a lot of people are going to be upset that I even pointed that out, because like these monsters in modern cinemascapes and books and shows and all this kind of stuff appear so differently. They also have very culty followings. And so people are obsessed with vampires, but not necessarily. I mean, look at Twilight. You got people who are obsessed with Team Edward, and then you got people who are obsessed with Team Jacob. And like, I know that's kind of a comical presentation, but look at Underworld. You got Team Lycan and Team Vampire, you know, and they fall in love in the middle. Kate Beckinsale is this vampire who falls in love with the Lycan. And it's, you have these two sides that appear to be perpetually warring with each other, and that extends to the fan base as well. People love their monsters in this modern age, and so they will probably reject the entire mythology of how it all began. But hey man, I'm just here showing you what I found, and don't worry, I'm already anticipating the people in the comments being like, this is not true, they're not the same thing, there's so many different tales about how they're different, blah blah blah. You're probably going to feel like there are, like, this whole episode is just hogwash, but listen, I'm just showing you what the ancient texts say. I don't care, personally. I really couldn't care less whether they're the same being or separate beings. But if you look at the ancient lore, if you look at the ancient tales, they are essentially the same. And the only thing that really changed throughout time is how we label them for mainly media and entertainment's sake. And after that happened, each side kind of developed their monster to fall in love with. And it's really, really interesting, too, when you think about how the old people actually thought of these things. Because they saw the werewolf as the entity that was essentially the living version of the monster. And they saw the vampire as what happens after it dies a lot of the times. And so what you end up getting is this perpetual fight, this battle between the living and the dead version of the same thing. It's kind of like the circle of life, right? The cycle of life, if you will. And that in of itself is poetic. But if you get real down to it, if you get down to the base, to ancient and medieval people, there wasn't a division between the two in most cultures. And if you find cultures where there is a distinct division, I mean, hey, that's fine too, because there probably were different types of monsters in different types of the world. So, yeah, I'm sure there are vampiric beings in other parts of the world that don't have or never have werewolf qualities, but in the etymology that we're studying, it really does seem like they're the same exact thing, and the ancients believed that. A werewolf was simply what a cursed person became in life, and a vampire was what that same cursed being became in death. The transformation cycle was fluid. A wolf-bound killer might rise as a revenant. A revenant might manifest wolfish features. The spirit of either might possess a living human and create another of its own kind. That's where, you know, you get bit by the zombie, you turn into a zombie kind of idea comes from. The creature was not defined by its form, but by its condition, an inherited corruption, a curse transmitted through blood, through sin, or through profane death. Greek theologians blamed all of these other things on it, but at the root of it, it was basically the same disease. And archaeology backs this up too. There's archaeological discoveries all over the place that corroborate the idea that the ancients feared really one category of revenant rather than many. You know, we've been talking a lot about the Greeks because they documented this stuff more than anyone, but across the Greek world, burials appear in which suspected undead were pinned into their graves beneath stones, all the things that we've already mentioned. But later, Byzantine and Ottoman graves contained bodies staked, spiked, or dismembered in the same manner. And this is seen throughout the Balkans. None of these graves identify the creature by type. They're not vampire burials or werewolf burials. They're simply measures taken against a restless dead, whatever form they might assume upon rising. It was only later, during the 18th century vampire panic, essentially, once it manifested in other parts of Europe, and the subsequent codification in works like Zedler's Universal Lexicon and whatnot, that the Slavic and Greek traditions were essentially merged and then culturally split into two different entities, the vampire and the werewolf. And so in this instance, some might say, well, see, this is evidence that they discovered that there were actually two different monsters. That's fine, but if we follow the folklore, the archaeology, the linguistic lineage, the theological history, the conclusion is unavoidable. Vampires and werewolves were once understood as phases of the same creature. That's just the end of it, my friends. So, I'm sorry, Team Jacob. Sorry, Team Edward. But y'all are on the same side. And that was the message of Twilight in the end anyway, right? But tales of the dead craving blood are not a quirk of one era or one region. They are a structural feature of human mythology and ancient history, and they appear all over the place with unnerving consistency across the entire ancient world. Some of the earliest written civilizations that had no contact whatsoever with each other, independently imagined the same terrifying figure, this corpse figure, this spirit, or a hybrid of both that would rise from the darkness to consume the living. You have it in Mesopotamia, among the oldest cultures to ever record their myths in clay tablets, the Lilu spirits, and they appear in this Babylonian demonology as a nocturnal revenant that preys upon humans. Even older Sumerian texts speak of the Akh-Akhar, blood-sucking female demons who hunted at night, especially stalking newborn infants and pregnant women. And these were not metaphorical figures. They were integrated into the moral and spiritual landscape of the time. So yeah, something was there even before the Greeks. And one of these demons, Lilithu, eventually crossed cultural borders and entered Jewish demonology as Lilith. And I don't like to talk about demon names these days. I don't really like projecting that into the world, but that's where it comes from, my friends. The infamous night stalker associated with infant mortality, seduction, and predation that so many wannabe witches worship. And this was long before the word vampire existed. The ancient Near East literally already articulated that template. Nothing new under the sun. And then you have far to the east in India. Sanskrit folklore introduces the Vatala, which is a ghoul-like being that inhabits corpses and animates them like puppets. These undead figures appear in the famous medieval compilation Baltal Pachisi, where King Vikramaditya attempts to capture a Vatala hanging upside down in a cremation ground tree. I know I probably said those names wrong, but I am a man of one tongue, not many. So, suck it. Get it? Anyway, isn't that kind of crazy that you have here, you know, yet another nod to the vampire lore of this bat-like being, this vampiric-like being that hangs upside down from a tree? And the Vatala is not merely a spirit of the dead, it's an entity that inverts the natural order. It occupies a human shell while remaining fully sentient. Its association with cremation grounds, graveyards, and twisted trees of India's haunted landscapes kind of establishes it within the global tradition of corpse-bound predators such as the vampire. And you got more and more all over the place. You got them in China, you got them in ancient Egypt, you got the Strix in Rome, which was like a nocturnal bird-like creature that fed upon human flesh and blood. And unlike the bats in this specific situation, the Strix was kind of imagined as a supernatural twisted kind of owl, which is way scarier if you ask me. It flew through the night essentially looking for children to devour, and it later became the Romanian Strigoi or the Striga. And the Balkans will even trace their etymology back to the Strix. So you have all of these different concepts of essentially what many will say is the same creature described all over the world in different ways. And just like there are many different people on the planet who do many different things or many of the same things in different ways, you probably have demonic entities and monsters that adapt to how the landscape in which they live is as well. And so you would have the same general type of creature that just lives in different ways, and that's why they're described in different ways as well. So if you're going to take any of this to heart, which I don't care if you do or not, because we're talking about vampires here, so it doesn't matter to me what you end up believing in the end. But we begin to see many tales varying slightly that have been combined to create the master of fairy tales. The vampire at its base, however, is not some handsome fellow in a top hat or a flowy silk blouse or who drives an Audi or who speaks in some obscure Balkan accent or has sparkly skins or that lives in some impregnable castle with an army of monsters. This is just the gothic fantasy of horny young ladies and incel beta boys with a fantasy for satisfying unhealthy, unhygienic outer course urges. And by now you may also see the connection to an entirely different, and yet possibly in some ways the same, type of entities. The succubus and the incubus. Because when you trace the vampire myth back through centuries of folklore and theological argument, it becomes almost impossible to ignore the web of connections that leads straight into the realm of the succubus and incubus. These entities These seductive demons that prey on men and women during sleep were not invented in medieval Europe either. They arise from the same deep mythological root system that produced the earliest blood-drinking spirits in human history.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
So again, you have these other entities entirely, the succubus and the incubus that we've been led to believe is a totally different type of creature preying on the life force of human beings. And of course, there's more than one type of spiritual entity that will prey on the life force of human beings, but the similarities are staggering and they should at least invite the question into your mind, could they be related? Are they the same thing? The idea that something non-human comes in the night to drain a person's essence, whether it's blood, breath, life force, sexual vitality, it's one of the oldest fears recorded in human storytelling. And in every region where this fear emerges, the boundaries between vampire, demon, and sexual predator, they all blur into one another. And that lineage begins, yes, in ancient Mesopotamia among the Sumerians, and then the Akkadians, and the Babylonians, and these early civilizations described a family of night demons known collectively as the Lilu, which, as we already said, seem to have transformed through time into the succubus, into the incubus, into the werewolf, into the vampire. And it just goes on and on and on. And just like these entities, you find the succubus and the incubus throughout history, blending and blending and blending like a perpetual smoothie of bullshit until you get to 18th century Europe, basically, where they attempt to make all of these things different because all of the sudden the world is becoming very civilized in a weird way. And the demons, these demonic entities begin to hide themselves better in technology. As we develop, they develop themselves as well. They become more hidden. And that is pretty much essential to their survival. Because I'm not saying I don't believe in these things. Obviously, if you guys have watched my show long enough, I have hundreds of episodes talking about how I do believe in these types of things. They have to survive as well. So if humanity forgets them, they lose. That's how it works. If humanity forgets them, they lose. They die. They have to be worshipped. They have to develop different costumes to wear. They have to be acknowledged in order to have any power whatsoever. Whether it's a fear, whether it's a fascination, whether it's an obsession, or whether it's, you think you're God's little demon hunter. That is how they have their power. And so in the 18th century, in Europe, in the Balkan states, and all that kind of the Slavic places, all of this kind of stuff, that's when they begin to develop a unique personality once again. And this time, they are handsome, they are sexy, they are misunderstood, but they are all still the same demons. Taken together, these myths do not form, in my opinion, a scattered constellation of unrelated nightmares. They are they form a straight line, a continuous tradition, a single archetype, a nocturnal human-adjacent predator that drains life from the living, sometimes through blood, sometimes through breath, sometimes through sex, sometimes through sheer parasitic presence. It is a shapeshifter in life as the wolfman, the werewolf, the lycan, the dogman, a revenant in death as the vampire, a parasitic spirit in between as the incubus, the succubus, the night demon. Cultures recognize different phases of it, not different species. And if the Enochian texts are taken seriously, the origin is even more explicit. A hybrid being, half spirit, half flesh, born of some forbidden union, cursed after death to wander the earth, consuming life force indefinitely. So yes, if the historical and the demonological threads are true, then all of these creatures are tributaries of one ancient river, one primal figure with many masks, the vampire, the werewolf, the incubus, the succubus, the night demon, the revenant, the Nephilim, the hybrid giant, the restless corpse, the life drainer, the predatory spirit, a single archetype echoing across continents and centuries, a being that refuses the boundaries of species, morality, death, or flesh. The ancient world did not describe many monsters in this specific situation. They described a monster in many forms. And we've been chasing this shadow ever since. It's almost like, yeah, wearing a different costume for each Halloween season. Nevertheless, you're the same you. The question then is, are they stuck in these forms once they choose them? A creature that survives by taking what others cannot afford to lose. The ancient world called them demons. The medieval world called them vampires. The modern world calls them elites. Different era, different mask, same archetype. Vampires do exist, my friends, but they conveniently change their faces, their disguises, their costumes, their names, and their positions in society. After all, and I can't go too far into this because I will get banned, I have been banned before for mentioning it, but adrenochrome. Just think about it. Adrenochrome. The game is keeping up with these things before they enthrall you with their promises of beauty and pleasure and unholy hunger. And why the hell do all of these celebrities and rich people keep somehow maintaining their youth? How do they do that? How do they never die? Why do they have so many plans for society? Why do they change their appearances? Why are they old one day and young the next? Just think about it for a moment, and then comment. Just think about it. The life is in the blood.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn,
and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.